Coming up on this week's show, a new Bitmap Brothers collection arrives.
A new way to get replacement Nintendo parts.
And we go inside the world of Japanese games developers with author John Shiponiak.
The Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every Friday with our incredible mates at Bitmap Books. Now, have you seen From Ants to Zombies, Six Decades of Video Game Horror? Now, this is one of my favourite books that they've released recently, covering more than 130 titles from the horror genre. Everything from 3D Monster Maze, Seventh Guest, Aliens Alone in the Dark, all the big ones are in here as well. And of course, it is in that gorgeous Bitmap Book style, spanning more than 600 beautifully illustrated pages. So you can check that out and the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 441. Your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And very nice to have you joining us for our little roundtable discussion every single Friday, where we bring you up to speed on what's been happening in the world of retro gaming and technology. And of course, every week on the podcast, we welcome on different guests from all aspects of the retro gaming community to tell us their stories. And of course, we have got another amazing guest on the podcast this week. This week, actually going inside the world of Japanese game developers. There's some really interesting stories on the way. But before we get into that, we have got a rather big announcement to make on the podcast this week. Speaking of some of our favourite interviews that we've ever done on this podcast, I'm actually holding a physical collection of them in our hand, because long-term listeners might remember that a couple of years ago, we actually did a Kickstarter for a book. And my God, how many messages have we had on social media, on email, people asking us whenever this is at events, how can I get hold of a copy of your book if I missed the Kickstarter?
We've been getting absolutely tons. And, you know, we printed a few extras after the Kickstarter as well. So, we're going to be making those available. But first, let everyone know who's actually in the book, Dan.
Yeah, so the idea of this book was basically a physical celebration of some of our favourite interviews. And I think when we did this, we're around episode, 300, 350, when we made the book. And we actually picked out a few of our all-time favourite guests who've been in the podcast. So to name a few names, Nolan Bushnell is in there, obviously the founder of Atari, the father of the video games industry, you could say. Dominic Diamond, who hosted Games Master here in the UK. Shiny Entertainment founder David Perry. Jeff Minter's in there as well. Trip Hawkins, founder of Electronic Arts and 3DO. Al Nilsson, Ken Williams, Ed Smith, John Bird, Wild Bill Steely. And also, this is not only a collection of some of our favourite interviews, but also there was a bunch of extra interviews that we did as well.
There were some exclusives. And the thing about the guests that we chose for this book and the interviews, you know, we wanted a wide-ranging selection from all around the world and lots of different systems and different eras as well. So, you know, it should have a bit of something for everybody there. But also, we had, Dylan Cuthbert as well, famous for Star Fox. We had Motohiro Kawashima as well, very famous for Streets of Rage 2 soundtrack. And that was really interesting to do because, as you're going to hear from this week's interview, Japanese translation is very hard. You know, getting people into books is a really important thing to, you know, get that area of the world represented. Henk Nyborg as well, who is one of my favorite pixel artists in the world. Some of his stuff's absolutely amazing. You know, Misadventures of Flink, Lionheart, Shanti as well. And Andrew Braybrook, you know, with classics like Iridium and Paradroid as well.
Yeah, so we won't go on too much about the books. We appreciate we did give it the hard sell in the past as well. But just want to say, if you ever wanted a copy of the Retro Hour book, it is really now or never, isn't it? Because we have got how many copies? About 80 copies at your
about
house, Ravi?
About 80, yeah. I was just doing the stock check and then and then we're totally out. We've got digital copies as well. So we're going to be selling it on, go to our website, theretrohour.com, and click on shop, and you'll be able to get an ebook version of the book or the physical book delivered to you.
Like we said, first come, first serve. So if you have been one of those people who've been asking us pretty much nonstop over the last 18 months or so, get them while you can.
And hopefully we'll have a few at Retro Messer as well.
Yes.
We're going to try and see how many we can take on the plane. It'll probably be like five or six or something. But we'll bring a few of those along.
Yeah, because we're going to be in Norway next weekend for our Retro Messa. If you want to get tickets for that, that'll be in the show notes as well. But let's talk about this week's guests then. Now, obviously, we didn't mention them. We were talking about the book, that it is often hard to get information about the games industry in, let's be honest, I mean, you know, the other big gaming history market. I mean, you think about America, obviously we had stuff like Atari came out of there, but really, I mean, a large portion of video game history came out of Japan, you know, even thinking of stuff like, you know, some of those massive arcade companies, you know, Sega, Nintendo, all came out of Japan. And today we're going to be going inside the world and finding out some untold history of Japanese game development.
Yeah, so we've got John Szczepioniak on, and, you know, John, he worked for Imagine Publishing, you know, Retro Gamer magazine as well, writes for Time Extension, did some stuff for Games TM as well. So he's been a video game journalist and author for quite a while, but he did this amazing Kickstarter where, you know, he actually thought, I'm going to go out to Japan. It's going to be really hard to, you know, engage with these people from a distance doing it online. So I'm going to go out there, actually meet the developers, hire a translator and get it properly done. And, you know, this is one of the most extensive histories I've seen. And he's got four volumes of it as well. Yeah. So the kind of approach of this interview where we talk to him, we talk about, like, you know, some of the influences that these developers had, their journey to becoming developers. You know, there's mention that the ZX Spectrum in there and some Japanese developers, you know, playing with Spectrums. And, you know, it's just fantastic because it's a total different world. But then we're also familiar with some of the games.
Yeah, and, you know, the amount of people he spoke to out there as well, because obviously, like you said, he had to organise this trip and basically plan in meeting all of these developers on a bit of a roadshow across Japan. Yeah. Didn't he get them all booked in? So he's like, I've got 2 weeks here. I've got to do a couple every single day. So the fact that he even worked this out is incredible.
And some of the people he's talking to, you know, like Yuzo Koshiro, it's just insane. And he's also talking to some of the companies that we wouldn't know behind them. We're talking about stuff like the PC-98 as well, MSX. I wish Joe was on this one, actually, because he would have totally fanboyed over it.
Yeah, but you can listen and fanboy, Joe.
I will listen and fanboy.
Post-fanboy.
Yeah.
So a nice little insight into the world of Japanese game development with our special guest, John Szczepioniak. He'll be coming up on the show in around half an hour from now. But of course, you know the way it works. First off the podcast, that's when us nerds geek out about what's been happening in retro from over the last week. And I must admit, this time of year when we're all traveling around, obviously we're going to be on a plane next week heading over to Norway Ravi, looking at this thinking, oh, might be time to get the Evercade dug out again, because there are some more great collections on the way, starting with the second Bitmap Brothers collection.
This looks really cool. I don't want to go straight into the games because there's a game on here where I'm like, ooh, this may be a more affordable way to play this game for me.
But I think I know which one you mean as well.
So this is the Bitmap Brothers Collection 2 for the Evercade, which comes with 6 games. But what's interesting about these games is they are all the Amiga versions of these games. So on the first collection, it was actually the console ports of the games.
Yes.
Which a few people were disappointed with.
Including me.
They weren't actually the Amiga versions, whereas this is the Amiga version, which is pretty cool. So the games include
everything apart from Z or Z, which
Z,
was
Z,
yeah,
which
yeah,
is the one I want to play. So you get Cadaver, The Payoff, Gods, Magic Pockets, the Chaos Engine 2, and then Z, and it says it's the 32-bit version. So I just assumed that was an Amiga version of it. But
well, I think Z was planned to come out on the Amiga. But then
is it Z or Z? Because Bitmap Brothers are British developers.
I Ooh. Always heard it as Z.
Yeah, sort of.
Yeah.
I'm going
to say
YouTubers.
Zed just to...
Just yeah,
to
let's just say Zed.
There you go. Zed was an interesting title because I think it was meant to come out on the Amiga at some point. But then they had... you know, they went onto the PC, and when it came out with the PC, it was a really weird one because I've tried to emulate it or run it on the PC. Mm-hmm. I get so many errors with screen issues and how it's displayed, how it's running at the wrong speed and stuff. So it'd be nice to actually see it running well on a system because it's a really fun game. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like you take control of certain areas and go around. It's good
it's
to see.
It's a real-time strategy game, isn't it?
Yeah, but looking overall at this game, and I think you know, Zed is the saving grace here, because they're not the best titles.
Oh, Gods is good,
but come Magic on. Pockets, meh. Chaos you know Engine what? 2, meh.
You know what, though? Yeah, I think in many ways, because Cadaver, I wasn't familiar with that game back in the day, but that is on the A500 Mini.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you played around with that, Joe, when you loaned my A500
no,
Mini
I didn't
a while
play that
ago.
One, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I'd kind of booted it up and looked around for a bit, and I wasn't really sure what was going on, if I'm honest. Mm. But a lot of people that do like the game say it's really good, so it could be one that's worth another look. Gods, yeah, I think, you know, that is probably the standout title on this list for me. Magic Pocket, again, Ravi, I agree with you there. I always thought that was an overrated game, if I'm honest, back in the day. I know it is generally considered one of the best Amiga platformers. Great music, obviously, the Betty Boo kind of intro music on it, but rest of the game, yeah, I thought it was pretty generic. Chaos Engine 2, though, which is an interesting inclusion, because obviously we've done interviews with Mike Montgomery in the past on the podcast, and, yeah, you know, we've talked about Zed, which was kind of the game that financially crippled the Bitmap Brothers, but also Chaos Engine 2, which was their final Amiga release. I've got a feeling that came out really late. It was like 1997.
Yeah.
That game was released.
And I think they sold hardly any of them, but also
2,000 units, apparently.
Yeah, I'm also just thinking they've got to put these in because they've got no other games. Yeah. You know, if they're doing a second collection, it's like that is, there's a few tiny ones, but that's it for the Bitmap Brothers, you know. Yeah, I'm not totally dissing it. You know, I get it for Gods and Zed and, you know, yeah. Each person has their own personal taste, doesn't it?
And Chaos Engine 2, I think if you play that with another person, you know, like a couch gaming kind of mode, you know, with, a,
yeah,
with another physical
maybe
player.
I didn't give it a chance back in the day, so it's kind of just it, like,
it's a very different mechanic. It's more like a spy versus spy kind of game.
Yeah.
Even though the graphics look very similar to the original, it doesn't play like Chaos Engine 1 at all. And if you play it against the computer, it thrashes you every time because it's kind of, the AI's way overpowered in it. But I think if you play it with another player, it's actually quite a fun experience. And probably a game that a lot of people haven't played. Like I said, it only sold 2,000 copies. And only ever came out on the Amiga. So I think for a lot of people, it might be, you know, maybe a bit of a hidden treasure that people might kind of
give
a fair crack of the whip to.
And I guess this is with Amiga as well, which it says Amiga at the bottom of the actual Evercade cart.
The Amiga collection, yeah.
Yeah, which is interesting because, you know, Zed isn't an Amiga title. They've kind of slipped it in there.
Yeah, forget that one. Yeah, the rest are there. But yeah, it's great to see. And I think, you know, like I said, we love these kind of curated collections that come out on the Evercade platform as well. Because, you know, we always talk about it when you've got like Everdrives and stuff for your consoles or WHG load on your Amiga, the amount of doom scrolling you do, just trying to pick a game and stick with it. I think having these nice little collections of games that they've curated are really good. And actually the pricing on this is reasonable as well, £17.99, and that's going to be going up on pre-order on August the 30th, so only a couple of weeks to wait. So I'll link that up in this week's show notes if you want to check that out. There is a trailer online right now. This is cool to see, and I love the fact that these can actually be used to fix up your old school Nintendo controllers, because these are a new range of basically these are like little keyrings, aren't they, that they've released in Japan called are these Gashapon toys? Do you know about these, Joe?
Yeah, so I went to Japan in 2019. My wife became addicted to these Gashapon machines. So they're the machines where you put like, generally like 100 or 200 yen in the UK, a quid or whatever. And it's the, you turn it like a, you know, like a crank, and then a ball will drop out and you'll have a prize in it.
Yeah.
And they're really, really popular in Japan. They're in like every shop you walk in, or every game shop.
Can't you get a
shop.
Huge variety of stuff as well that comes out of them?
Yeah, yeah. So generally, there's even Gashapon shops where there's hundreds and hundreds of them lined up, and there will be one, and it'll have a poster on the front of it, and it'll tell you this is a Final Fantasy one, and you get, there's like 10 characters in there from Final Fantasy VII, and the next one will be, this is a Pokemon one, but it's the water Pokemon. So it's always you don't know what you're going to get, but you know what genre you're picking. Does that make sense? Yeah. Like, you know what, you know, IP you're picking. Like, there's so much, like, you know, it could be Dragon Ball Z, it could be, I'm not describing it.
Random which one's going to fall down.
Yeah. It's random which one's going to fall out, but you know what genre you're picking, if that makes sense, what IP you're picking. But Nintendo of Japan, in the Nintendo shop in Japan, have got their own ones. and they have been absolutely crazy. Apparently there's queues just, you know, kind of round the block outside the door for them, and they are the Nintendo Gashapons that they've just released. They are key rings with classic Nintendo controllers, starting with the Famicom all the way up to the GameCube. And all
it's
the
just parts of the controllers, isn't it? Just a section of them.
Yeah, it's just segments of the controllers. So just like a little circle, and you either get like the D-pad or the thumbstick or the C-stick from the GameCube, or you get the buttons. And it's you can get the Famicom, the NES, the Japanese SNES or the American SNES, and then the N64 and then the GameCube. Super popular. But what's really interesting, and this isn't something Nintendo have advertised, this is people who are buying them and then they're on X tweeting about it. These parts, these buttons, they're completely compatible with official Nintendo controllers.
With the original hardware, yeah.
Yeah, so if you take the back off of the Gashapon off the back of the little key ring, it has all the components of the buttons in there, and like, you know, the squidgy buttons, the rubber in there and everything.
Yeah, so it's even got like little Game & Watch ones as well.
Yeah.
It's just like the whole range of kind of controllers, really.
Yeah, it's crazy. And it's just all the components are in there and everything for you to swap it over. So N64 controllers, famously, they get a lot of stick drift, or the sticks aren't tight anymore. So it's a viable way to swap it over.
Well, it makes sense. I mean, they're not going to go to the effort of basically remaking these parts. If they've got the molds and everything already made, I guess it's a cheap way just for them to manufacture them again. Maybe these are like new old stock. They might have had loads of them in the warehouse
for years.
You know, just kind of put them into these. But yeah, I think that's really cool that there is now basically a replacement parts stock for your old Nintendo controllers. Because, I mean, for example, I don't know if you're the same on the GameCube, the C-stick always goes kind of literally goes sticky. You know, the rubber kind of perishes a bit. I've got a couple of them and they're all like...
I would say I see not so much the C-stick. I see the actual thumbstick.
Yeah.
Like the actual rubber coming off on them all the time.
Yeah.
Maybe they've like cut up a load of Nintendo mini controllers that they had spare. Or, you know, those new Game & Watches. And like, let's cut them up and use the spare bits.
Well, you make a good point there, because I imagine, you know, they would have been making the controllers again for the minis. So it would make sense of actually been making a lot of these. Again, I'm just waiting now for the rumours. N64 Mini on the way, because to be making these controls again, we won't get our hopes up on that. But awesome to see. And I mean, obviously these are only a thing that are really big in Japan, so a lot of people are like, you know, when are these going to be coming out in the West? Yeah. I wouldn't hold your breath on that.
Yeah, no news of them coming out in the West, unfortunately.
And I guess they could be like nice little fidget devices as well, you know? Like,
well, yeah. Yeah, they will be. Yeah, just sat at your desk.
Just sit there playing with a D-pad.
Or just play Nintendo games in your mind. Just imagine you're playing Mario or something. Yeah, so very cool to see. And I wait for these to go for extortionate prices now on eBay, now that everyone knows that. So those are available now if you're in Japan. Now, this is actually something I wasn't aware of. And probably because I've never got to the end of Streets of Rage. But apparently there was an alternate ending, a bad ending of Streets of Rage 1 that previously you could only access by having a second player.
I thought you were going to say it's because you didn't have any friends.
Well, there was that as well. Yeah. Or my own Mega Drive. You know,
yeah, all so there is two endings to Streets of Rage 1. I assume this was common knowledge, maybe. Maybe it's not. Maybe it is, and it's just Dan never finished Streets of Rage.
Probably.
But yeah, if you play two-player on Streets of Rage 1 for the Sega Mega Drive, when you get to Mr. X at the end, he asks you to join him. And if you both say no, then you just fight him as normal. If one of you says yes to joining you and one of you says no to joining you, it takes you back to level 6 and you have to do it again.
Oh,
if you
God.
Both say yes to joining him, you have to fight each other, whoever...
Like Double Dragon.
Double Dragon. You have to fight each other. Whoever wins that fight then goes on to fight Mr. X, and then you get an alternative ending where whichever character you play as is seen sitting in Mr. X's chair and becomes the new Syndicate bad guy. You've
brought back memories because this was the only way that we'd do it as well. And me and my mate John T, if you're listening, big up. We used to play it, and then we'd always be like, "Don't do that because you're going to go back."
God, yeah, but that was frustrating.
It was very.
But that caused a few arguments.
And you know what? This goes to show how young I was when I was supposed to do Series 1. Me and my friend Jack, big up Jack, we couldn't read when we'd get to the end, and we just knew. We didn't know what it was saying. We just knew which ones to pick to make sure we didn't go back. Like, you either pick the top, we both have to pick the bottom one, like, to make sure that we didn't go back to the sixth level. But yeah, famously, if you will, you couldn't access this ending on single player. You could only ever do it on two player. So Billy Time Games, who is a big Sega Mega Drive hacker, has put together a mod that allows you to do this on one player, is essentially the story, is the news article, just so you can access it through, I guess, it says official means, it's unofficial means because it's a mod to the game. It's a very small mod, but it gives you the option to join him, yes or no. And obviously, if you say yes, you still fight him, but then when you beat him, you get the bad ending. And it's the only way that you can get the bad ending on one player, it would seem, after 33 years of this game being out.
So if, like me, you've got no friends, as Joe pointed out, thanks, Joe, then this is a way to see it at home without having to bother anyone else. So this is available now on romhacking.net, so I'll put that in this week's show notes. Now, this is very cool to see, and this is something that we've been aware of, and anyone that listens to, like, This Week in Retro, another great podcast, and watches Neil RMC's YouTube channel, I'm sure will be aware of this. And actually, we were chatting a bit, I think, at your Kickstarter event in Nottingham last year, Ravi.
Yeah, he bought along this.
With Mike Daly, who formerly of DMA Design. And at the time, this was just something that basically he discovered. It was a PCB for a Lemmings arcade game that never got released.
Yeah, it was a
that now has been finished and is playable.
Yeah, it was a prototype from Data East about an arcade version of Lemmings. Now, the thing about it was, it's very different from the main game. You know, playing Lemmings on an arcade really doesn't seem like it would work, but actually it works quite well. Now, RMC from The Cave, great channel, has been doing these kind of recreations. He had a space war machine that they rebuilt, and now he's created something unique, because this was never an arcade cabinet. It was meant to happen. It never did. I think they had some original sketches, some of the stuff from, like, the menu screens. They made, like, little instructions from it. They've also got vinyl wrap on the side, like a Data East logo. They've got a lovely banner on there. It's done really well, and this is a kind of unique experience. It looks really good fun, and I think it's very special that you know, they have Mike Daly, the creator of Lemmings, involved, and he kind of approved it all and saw it, like, come to life, and it's pretty awesome. I just want to go and play on it, basically. It looks like a really good experience.
So you can actually go and play the world's only Lemmings arcade cabinet that Neil and the team there have restored, and it's now at the Retro Collective website. If you want to book a visit, you can go and check it out at the Arcade Archive, where the machine's currently on display, and have a go at it. And like you said, I mean, they've made this into a full, proper arcade cabinet with a CRT monitor in there, the artwork on the side of it, even the buttons
as well. You know,
yeah, that was what I was wondering. It's like, how do you play it with an arcade joystick or something? Makes sense that you play it with a trackball. I'm interested to have a play at this because, like you said, it is the only one that's out there, and I wonder kind of how it differs from
playing it on like a... Yeah, it does look very different. And the thing is, we used to have fun just doing two-player Lemmings. You and me just playing that together. But this looks like a total different experience, because the thing that you've got to have with an arcade game is pace, right? And, you know, that kind of fear. And I wonder how they do it. From the footage, it looks really good, but I'd love to sit down and play. I reckon this is going to be one of the most popular machines that he's got there, and it's very unique. They had this plan of putting this furry kind of lemmings fur around it. And I'm glad they didn't. They only in the video, they said they had a bit of it at the end, but it was getting stuck on Neil. So, yeah. and they do a great podcast. Also, if you check out Into the Vertical Blank podcast, they did a Retro Hour Verse This Week in Retro episode recently, which is...
Put Us at War.
Yeah, Put Us at War, which is a really interesting episode.
So I'll link that up in the show notes as well. But I mean, if you haven't seen something, I'm sure some people will point this out in the comments, at the Lemmings Arcade Cabinet, it is available to play in MAME. Has been a ROM hack of it available for about a year now. So you can play it at home if you want to check it out. And I'm looking at a long play here. It's nearly a two-hour long play. So I can see why this probably never made it into the arcades, because obviously arcade games are meant to keep you on for like a few minutes and get you off and get money off the next person, aren't they?
Yeah,
they don't want someone who's going
to
hog it.
It
like,
could be really tough, you know, with long players. Yeah. Some people tend to be really good. Yeah.
So, yeah, very cool to see. So if you want to check out the world's only Lemmings cabinet, you can go and check that out at the Retro Collective website. I'll link that up in this week's show notes. I wonder if someone's going to find a Zool arcade machine. Do you remember that?
Floating around back in the day, pictures of the Zool arcade.
Yeah, there was pictures. I think it was on Bad Influence on TV. Andy Crane was playing.
You're giving Neil ideas.
Yeah, the Zool arcade machine. So if that one ever surfaces, that's something that I've always wanted to play. And Rise of the Robots, I've got a film that was an arcade cabinet of that as well. I'm not sure whether that ever
it just
made
set
it into
on
the
fire
arcade.
Brian May has it.
Thought, yeah.
Killed itself.
we won't bother with that one. So just one more story to talk about before we chat to this week's special guest. And this game looks, I'm going to say, right up my street. Been a fan of Overhead Racers. Now, this is, they're calling it a mix of Project Gotham Racing and Micro Machines. And this is a new game for the Game Boy Color called Hoonigans.
Hoonigans. I keep reading it as Hooligans, but it's Hoonigans. Yeah. So this has been developed and made by Shane McCafferty, I think you say it. And like you say, it's a cross between Project Gotham Racing and Micro Machines. And it's for the Game Boy Color. And it only costs £1 to download the ROM.
Oh, wow.
Which is fantastic. So obviously you can play it on emulator, or I believe you can put it on an EverDrive and play it on your Game Boy Color. Looks cool. Very, very colorful and great, you know, gameplay and stuff for a Game Boy Color game. And I can't knock it because it's only a quid. But I don't see the Project Gotham Racing part myself. It just looks very Micro Machines to me, which I have no problem with. I like Micro Machines.
Yeah, it looks supercar-y kind of Micro Machines. I'm not sure, but wasn't there that weird mechanic in Project Gotham Racing with the kudos? Do you remember that? When you went around corners and it was
I only
like,
ever played it a couple of times.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe it's that.
Maybe I've got the total wrong game.
No, there was in Project Gotham
Racing. Yeah, so like you go around the corner and like you take it at a certain angle or something and it'd be like, you get kudos.
Yeah. Kind of like Ridge Racer when you get your... nitros and stuff.
Maybe that's involved with it, like taking the corners, there is boosts and stuff when you
take the corners in this. So there we go. There's my answer. Fantastic.
Yeah, because I mean, yeah, it is really. I mean, it's if you like Micro Machines and supercars and skid marks and 80. There's a lot of these games back in the day. Some of them play better than others. By the looks of this, I mean, I like the fact that the camera kind of tends to zoom in and kind of zoom out, you know, depending on what you're doing in the game.
Yeah.
Because sometimes the view of, you know, especially when you're playing this on a handheld, I imagine you want to kind of see enough of the road in front of you to figure out what's going on and take the turns and things.
It kind of reminds me of the original GTA in that sense. Do you remember on the original GTA when you were driving really fast, the camera would zoom out for you?
Yeah.
It does remind me of that. Obviously, graphically, it's very different. It's more akin to Micro Machines. But yeah, it does remind me of that, actually, now you say it.
Yeah, and there's auto acceleration in the game as well. Obviously, I mean, there's only videos at the moment on X. We haven't actually downloaded this to give it a play. Playing it on original hardware, it does look like the system does lag a little bit at times.
Mm-hmm.
There's some like kind of slightly jerky scrolling. Looking at these videos again, it could just be an artifact of the capture that they're using for it. But you know, I'm a fan of these kind of games anyway. But I think it's for the sake of £1, if you have got a Game Boy lying around, your Game Boy Color, and you want something good to play in it over the summer. Looks like it, could be worth a buy. Were you a fan of these kind of games back in the day, Joe? Did you play many of these other races?
We had Micro Machines for the Sega, Mega Drive. We had, is it Micro Machines 96? I think it is. And we had the military one. Really loved them. Obviously, graphically, they're a little bit different to kind of like the original ones. the Amiga one and stuff like that. But yeah, always enjoyed Micro Machines, and then actually had a night with you where we played Micro Machines on the Amiga all night drunk, and I have done that with my friend Stevie as well, and it was very funny.
It reminds me a bit of Retro City Rampage as well.
Yeah, a little bit.
Just
the
look of it, you know.
And there's Overdrive as well from Team 17.
Oh, I've not played.
Don't
that
remember
one.
That game.
That was
a good overhead racer as well, because it did seem like in the mid 90s suddenly there was a massive kind of spate of these games coming along, and then they just kind of faded away. I did get the, you know, there's like a new version of Micro Machines that they made for the Xbox One, probably going back about 7-8 years.
Yes, they did. I didn't play that one. It was,
didn't really work for me.
Micro Machines V3, I like that on
the PS1.
Yeah, that was a good one. Yeah.
So, like I said, for the sake of a quid, if you want, you know, any one of these overhead races to play for your Game Boy Color, could be worth a punt. That is available now. So I'll link that up. And of course, all the rest of the stories we talk about, you don't have to Google around. I save you the job each week. I put them in the show notes on your podcast app, or you can head to our website at theretrohour.com. Now, before we hop into this week's special guest, just a moment to give a big thank you to one of our regular sponsors. That is our lovely friends at ExpressVPN. Now, we're big supporters of ExpressVPN, and obviously the subject of online privacy is a massive deal these days. And you can think about, you know, going online without ExpressVPN. It's almost like forgetting to mute yourself on a Zoom meeting. You know, you could have your co-workers here and you are talking about them in the room. I'm sure you're nice about them all the time, or flushing the toilet if you take Zoom calls with your camera off, hopefully. There's several occasions when you might not want people to hear you. But obviously, privacy online is a massive deal. And we're going to be traveling soon, like we said. I mean, we're off to Norway. You're going to be heading up to Sweden for a while as well. So that means, I imagine, lots of public Wi-Fi hopping in airports and coffee shops and that kind of thing.
Hotels and stuff, which, you know, it's always good to be protected there, because ExpressVPN reroutes your traffic 100% of it through secure encrypted service. So your ISP can't see your browsing history as well, which is always good when you're kind of shopping online as well, because I always get suggested the stuff that I've bought about 1,000 times as well.
Well, in America, it's actually legal for ISPs to sell your browsing information to advertisers. So, you know, if that bothers you, which it should, ExpressVPN will reroute all your traffic through their secure service. It hides your IP address as well, making it difficult for third parties to track your online activity. And the thing that we really love about ExpressVPN is it works on all your devices. You can have it on your phone, your laptop, your tablet, even your smart TV, stay private on the go. And it's so simple to use, isn't it? It's literally fire up the app, one click of a button, and it's rated number one by the top websites like CNET, The Verge as well. So if you want to protect your online privacy today, ExpressVPN is a service that we've used for many years and we suggest. So if you'd like to try them out, we've got you a great offer. Head to this link so they know that we sent you, expressvpn.com/retro, and you will get 3 months free on top of a one-year plan. So use that exclusive link, expressvpn.com/retro. I'll put that in this week's show notes. And a massive thank you to our friends at ExpressVPN for their support of our show. Okay, well, thank you for checking out the news this week. We'll have more for you on next Friday's podcast. And next, going inside the world of Japanese game developers with our special guest, John Szyponiak. He's coming up next on the Retro Hour podcast.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle.
With ultra titanium alloy metal.
You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and I'm here with John Szyponiak. How are you doing, John?
I'm doing well, thank you very much.
Well, I'm really glad to have John on the show. You know, he's previously worked for Retro Gamer. He was a staff writer there, also Time Extension. But he's authored a very unique history, and this is the untold history of Japanese game developers. It's going to be a really interesting interview because you know what John does? He actually went out to Japan and interviewed everyone. So, you know, we got some really interesting insights into the Japanese game scene that you don't usually get in the West. We got a question that we always ask our guests, and that was, what was your first gaming memory?
My earliest gaming memory would be Pac-Man in the arcades, or, I mean, arcade machines were basically found everywhere. So there was like a little corner shop, and whenever my dad went to get, you know, basic groceries, I'd go with him, and I was too short to reach the controls, so we'd get one of those milk crates and flip it upside down so I could stand and play Pac-Man. So that's the earliest memory I have of any sort of video game.
So do you remember when you got your first home system then, and why did you get it?
Yes, actually. So I was born and grew up in South Africa, which had a kind of an unusual or somewhat different gaming ecosystem to the rest of the world. Nintendo had attempted to get a foothold in the market there, which it never really worked. Very, very few official products came out in like a small kind of test market. But what was very successful there were bootleg Famicom clones from, imported from Hong Kong or Taiwan. So my family were visiting family friends, and their son had a bootleg Famicom clone and Famicom multi-carts. And, it just kind of blew my mind that having played arcade games like Pac-Man, you could now play these games at home. So we played all evening. I thought it was incredible. And, my parents spoke with his parents on where you could get one of these systems. And it all started off from there. So my first home system was basically a clone of the Japanese Famicom, and I had a multi-cart with 32 different Famicom games on it. Galaga, Galaxian, Super Mario Brothers, some games which never came out in Europe, such as Battle City, Macross. So yeah, that was my introduction to playing games at home. And I feel it kind of planted a seed in my mind, because playing these Famicom bootleg games, you'd go into a store and there'd just be this, kind of display of kaleidoscope of colors, video game cartridges, turquoise, yellow, pink, etc., with these bright Japanese labels. And you didn't quite know what you were going to get all the time, based on the label. And there were a lot of games which were never mentioned in the magazines, which, because you could buy imported magazines from America and the UK, and the games in the stores didn't always quite match up with those. So everything felt kind of mysterious or strange or, kind of exciting, because it was almost unfathomable, if that makes sense. It felt kind of very, very exotic, where you would see a game mentioned in a, let's say, whatever popular magazine at the time you were reading, EGM or GameZone from the UK or whatever. And, sometimes these games would be available in the stores. But if not, it was just weird Japanese games, which you never saw documented anywhere else. And obviously this is long before the internet. So it's not like you could just look up what this information was. So it was, everything felt like this kind of exciting discovery.
So was it reading those magazines that inspired you to start writing about games?
No, actually I fell into writing about games completely by accident. I had no intention of doing this, and I'm amazed that I'm even, that I ended up where I am. I wanted to go to university. Initially, I went to university to study Japanese because I thought I could, live in Japan and, see Japan, because I like playing video games and I like Japanese food and Japanese culture. After 3 months, I decided that studying Japanese was too difficult. It wasn't really my thing. And I dropped out of university, and the intention was to go back and study classical art because I also liked painting. I liked to post on forum boards at the time, and an editor on a magazine on Games TM's retro section saw some of my posts on this forum board. So, for example, I did a long forum post on how the South African gaming scene was different. And I spoke to some of my friends who grew up in different countries, and I basically annotated or described their different perspective, just as an interesting forum topic, to get discussion going about, did you grow up in a slightly different or exotic location? What was gaming like for you in that place? And the editor saw this and said to me, that's really interesting. Could you, delete the forum topic, but take your statement and your friend's statements and, give it to me as an article, and I'll pay you in games. So I did that. And my first article was called Wish You Were There in Games TM. And it looked at video games in South Africa, Russia, Brazil, Iran, just from, you know, chatting with people who I knew had lived there. And, you know, I found this all very exciting and unusual because obviously it was very much removed from, you know, what one would have grown up with, let's say if you're growing up in the UK or America. So that was my first article. And then he said, oh, do you want to do another article? And then I think I wrote about Metal Gear, the Metal Gear series for my second piece, because I was a big fan of that, of this series. And I'd played all of the 2D games, including the Japanese-only MSX2 game, Metal Gear 2 Solid Snake. And this was before Konami had re-released it. So that was my second article, and he paid me in games. And then he was like, oh, do you want to write another article? I can pay you in money this time. And then I was like, instead of going to university, I was thinking, oh, I can get paid to write about video games. Sure, I'll do this.
Well, it was a really interesting Kickstarter that you did, because you actually had funding in there to go out to Japan, do the whole trip, and, you know, meet the devs there, talk to them personally, and also get a translator. Why was it important to do that?
So I had done interviews with Japanese developers previously via email, usually through PR departments. And that's incredibly frustrating because you're at the whim of the PR person translating the English into Japanese. You are reliant on them not filtering out any sensitive answers that they get back, and then also relying on them translating it into good English. I mean, I remember one example when I was working on Retro Gamer magazine, Sega contacted us, I think it was for their Mega Drive collection on the PSP or PS2, and they wanted Mega Drive coverage. And they were like, you know, we can get you interviews with key people in Japan, you know, just send us questions. So I thought to myself, I'm going to send them the best, most hardcore intellectual questions about the Mega Drive, which no one else would have asked them, like really out there, you know, to get great information that's never been documented before. And the PR guy got back and said, these questions are too complicated for me to translate. Can you try giving me simpler questions? And I had to dumb it down. And I thought to myself, oh my God, this is like, this opportunity is being wasted here, in that Sega was willing to answer questions, but because I had to go through, I don't know, whoever it was doing the translating and the liaising, it just fell short. And, you know, there've been other times where you get answers back and you can definitely tell that they've curated or truncated it or just removed pieces. So I wanted to get right to the source. I wanted to bypass all of that. I wanted to speak to people face to face. And a lot of the inspiration came from, there was a book, Family Computer 1983 to 1994. It was by the Tokyo Metropolitan Museum of Photography. For the anniversary of the Japanese Famicom, they had a photograph of every Famicom game fully boxed and 10 interviews, just raw, pure Q&A interviews with, I believe it was 10 major developers. Miyamoto, the creator of Earthbound, Yuji Naka, interviewing him from the perspective of being a rival to Nintendo, Hideo Kojima, 10 major developers. And the answers were pure and raw and unfiltered, and there were two columns of text, one in Japanese and then the translation in English, and really heartfelt, sometimes just wacky answers. Like, I remember Hideo Kojima said that he'd glued a Japanese coin to the Famicom controller and it made his hands smell kind of funky. And I just thought to myself, you know, it's so weird, but it's entertaining. It's interesting to read these recollections. And I wanted to recreate that sort of, I suppose the word is, you know, kind of this intimacy where a developer lets their guard down and they really share their, you know, their personal memories, their recollections, their inner feelings, without any sort of, you know, company overview saying, you know, oh, that's, you know, maybe you shouldn't be discussing that topic or anything. I didn't want anything to hinder it. I just wanted, you know, a cascading waterfall of information that had never been known before. So in that regard, it was quite challenging. But yeah, my belief was, if I can get to Japan and I can bypass PR companies and I can get a really good interpreter to communicate with them easily, then I will get answers and information that nobody has ever heard before.
Well, obviously, I mean, planning this journey, you've only got a limited amount of time to get this done when you're there. I mean, what kind of challenges did you have planning that trip, and how did you choose which developers to interview?
In terms of planning, I wrote out a meticulous calendar, and I would fill in, and I provided the calendar to interviewees in order for them to suggest which day was good for them, and I tried to fill in as many days as possible. In the end, basically every day just about had an interview in it or something related to the project. I think over the course of 3 months, 90 days, I had like 5 days off, so it was very intensive. It was a case of reading previous interviews, if they'd done any, finding interviews if they'd done them in Japanese. Some of them had never been interviewed, so it was a case of going through Mobi Games, looking at their portfolio, looking at who their colleagues had been, projects they'd worked on, projects they were close to, even if they hadn't necessarily worked on them. Just really kind of really getting down into the small details, printing out, having a folder with a plastic wallet for each individual and printing out lists of their games, topics to cover. I was quite obsessive with going in there and because I didn't just want to ask questions that had been asked plenty of times before. I really wanted to get stuff no one had heard before. So endless printing of sheets, writing down of notes in notebooks, working with Joseph Redon of the Japanese Game Preservation Society. He had a lot of contacts, and it was great to bring him on board as well, because while I knew about a lot of these Japanese games from a Western or a European perspective, him living and working in Japan, he brought a lot of information that perhaps only players in Japan would have known, you know, a lot of the really obscure facts or trivia. So we were able to bring both of these together and conduct some great interviews. With regards to your question of, you know, how did I decide who to select? Wow, that is a good question, because there's a lot to unpack there. Initially, I had a list of contacts that obviously I had made during my career writing about games. So I already had a small list of contacts that I could call upon to interview again. I did a lot of kind of just out of the blue, randomly contacting different Japanese developers through their websites, through social media, Facebook, Twitter, online companies, contacting companies directly in some instances, relying on Joseph Redon and his contacts to put me in touch. So, for example, I interviewed Yoshio Kiya, the creator of Legacy of the Wizard on the NES. He arranged that for me. And I found that once I'd gotten a few developers on board, they all had friends and colleagues who worked with them on certain projects or worked at different companies, and then they would put me in touch with other people. Essentially, I utilized every resource at my disposal, and the interviewees, the list of them grew very quickly. In some instances, I was being invited to do more interviews while I was in Japan. In one instance, I remember this quite vividly. I was having lunch at RZest with a lot of former Sega employees. So Naoto Oshima, the creator of Sonic the Hedgehog, the creator of Shinobi in arcades, Yoji Ishii, who created Fantasy Zone and was a producer on Outrun, and we're all having lunch there. And I'm asking them, have any of you heard from the creator of Alex Kidd on the Master System? Because he's quite a mysterious figure. I'd never seen any interviews of him in English. I'd seen one interview in Japanese, but he basically kind of disappeared. And Yoji Ishii was like, oh yeah, I've got him on speed dial. He whips out his mobile phone, and I quickly took out my phone to take a photograph of this because it's great. And, you know, on the left, you've got the creator of Shinobi. On the right, you've got the creator of Sonic. And in the middle, you've got the creator of Fantasy Zone. And he's on the phone to the creator of Alex Kidd. And he's going, yeah, there's this guy from England, traveled to Japan. He wants to interview you. Can you meet him tomorrow? And that's literally how some of these interviews went. It was just someone calling a friend, saying, you know, describing my project. And then I would just, you know, kind of rock up at their office with my cameraman and my interpreter in tow. And, you know, the interview would happen. Of course, you know, the night before that, I was up until midnight getting sheets printed off and, you know, making sure that I had a list of all of their games and information so that I could go into the interview prepared. But sometimes that's just how it happened. And by the end of the trip, developers were, like, I remember one developer, Hidenori Shibao, he offered me 7 different contacts who had worked on console games, arcade games, including some big developers. And sadly, I just had to say to him, I literally do not have a single day off for the next, I think it was 3 weeks still to go. I didn't have one day off. Every day had something going on until I literally had to get on the plane and leave the country. So there was no way to add in extra interviewees by that point. So, I mean, in the end, I just had to turn down interviews. So,
Really good position to be in there. I was wondering if you could tell us then about some of the really early developers that you talked to. Roy Ozaki as well, with Mitchell Corporation. You know, they're famous for Pang, which is an absolutely awesome game that went on many systems. Also Strider as well, maybe one that, you know, our friends would recognize that listen to the podcast. Namco System 10 board as well, and PC 98, and working with Data East as well, and Toki. So tell us about that kind of interview and how important Mitchell Corp were.
The Roy Ozaki interview was pretty cool, actually. That took place, I believe, over 2 or 3 days. I met Roy, and with him was his friend Koichi Otsui, who created Strider. And we had lunch on the mountainside, and I was given a tour of the mountains, and I was staying at this small ryokan, this little Japanese inn, and Roy's idea was that we'd go to the inn and we'd have a, you know, a big meal and, you know, drink a lot of beer and sake, and all the stories would come out. And, you know, it was fantastic because we were sitting there eating and drinking until, you know, I'd say midnight, you know, discussing. Roy gets quite verbose after a few drinks. So there were a lot of fascinating stories about Yakuza involvement in the games industry, how, you know, you had to stand your ground when dealing with them. A few statements which perhaps had to be redacted at the end. I don't think he would have been happy if I'd printed some of the material. But
some drunken tales.
that kind of exemplifies the you know, the relaxed atmosphere that I was hoping for in kind of getting this information. And he was describing life in the industry in a way that you wouldn't get through a PR-controlled email interview. So I think I ended up with like 7 hours of audio, because the next day after I left the ryokan, I traveled to Roy's house to take photographs of his various awards that he'd received for. So like he had an award from Capcom for, you know, shifting a lot of arcade units. He was a distributor for Street Fighter II. He was showing me all of this, you know, this cool memorabilia of his, which I was photographing. Koichi Otsui brought a painting which he had hand-painted of Strider as part of the creation process. And I continued to interview them in a very casual, relaxed setting. I mean, it was great fun. You know, we were all just sitting there, you know, our shoes off inside Roy's living room, kind of just sharing personal anecdotes. And so that was quite a lengthy section. And then Roy showed me his cupboard where he keeps, you know, all of the old, like the source code on floppy disks. And it was like, you know, just rummage around through all of the old stuff and, you know, photograph whatever you like. And so I'm going through this cupboard of all this old materials, floppy disks and computer-related materials. And I find this giant box and I lift the lid. And what I see at the top is the tops of 4 human heads and long black hair. kind of. And I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, is he secretly some sort of serial killer and I'm going to be murdered and that my head is going to be in a box and they're never going to find my body? And then Roy's like, oh yeah, those are my daughter's practice heads. She's a hairdresser. And I was like, oh.
They were made of plastic, just to clarify.
Yeah, that's why it's basically mannequin practice heads. But I mean, you wouldn't know this just from lifting the lid up. All you would see is the tops of 4 solid heads and this, you know, this neat black hair. And, you know, so that, I don't know, that I, you know, I had a mild heart attack there, but I went through all of the development materials. And what was quite cool afterwards is he said that he wanted to license out basically any of Mitchell Corp's games. And so I put a little advertisement or, you know, explanation page saying, if anybody's interested, please contact them directly. Here is a list of games. And you know, it took a few years, but so Osman or Cannon Dance, so that ended up being re-released. I don't know if you recall that. And some of the other games were licensed. I think some of them ended up on the Evercade. I'm not sure. I spoke to the gentleman behind Evercade and put him in touch with Roy. So it was gratifying afterwards to not only to have gotten the inside story, but also to have helped him get the message out there that you know, these games are available for re-release if anybody's interested.
Was there any connection to English developers and like systems like the Spectrum out there? Like, kind of, what was the influence that the UK had on Japanese developers? Right. So, did you find any?
Great. Yes. Yes. So much. That is an excellent question. Actually, the next thing I wanted to bring up was these early developers and their connection to the British side of things. So I found Takashi Takebe. He was the sixth employee at Hudson right in the early 1980s. Hudson, obviously, being the developer of Bomberman. And he was describing how, in the early days, Hudson was creating computer games for early Japanese computers released on cassette tape. Normally, one programmer would take a week to program some very simple kind of basic game. And their initial business plan was volume, you know, get as many of these out, you know, one game every week, just quickly release them in order to, you know, garner some sales and get some profit. And then they shifted from that policy over to quality over quantity. And Takebe was describing how he had traveled to London to a big computer fair in London. I think this was 1983. I can't remember the exact date that he cited, but he saw the ZX Spectrum and he spoke with developers and publishers in the UK, and Hudson adopted a lot of the, or they learned a lot and they took a lot of guidance from the way the British computer scene, specifically the ZX Spectrum, was developing at that time. It also resulted in several of Hudson's games being released on the ZX Spectrum. So some people might recall Eric and the Floaters. That was basically the ZX Spectrum version of Bomberman. Hudson took inspiration from computers like the ZX Spectrum. They took that knowledge and information back to Japan, and it influenced how they did business. I also spoke to Masakuni Mitsuhashi of Game Arts, and prior to Game Arts, he was developing early computer games, and he was describing he made a first-person maze game for the MSX, and we were chatting about this, and he was saying how 3D Monster Maze on the ZX81 was his inspiration for that, which surprised me because I thought to myself, how would 3D Monster Maze make it to Japan? So, I asked him, how did you even know about that? And he described how Japanese magazines would examine and cover the international video game or computer, the international computer scene. So games that were coming out in England, such as 3D Monster Maze, were documented in here. And then I did a little bit of digging even further, and I discovered that the ZX81 computer itself was actually sold in Japan. And, you know, I found advertising leaflets, advertising lists, and Japanese hobbyists or enthusiasts produced their own type-in listings in Japan for the ZX81, which archivists now are attempting to type those up and preserve them. So
that's amazing, because I thought it would have just been MSX or PC-98, you know, those kind of machines. But the fact that they've got a love for the Spectrum as well over in Japan is great.
I mean, exactly. So this is like one of my goals was to discover, you know, these untold stories. And it succeeded magnificently because it completely recontextualized my understanding of the history of video games in Japan. You know, a lot has been said about Japanese game developers buying imported Apple II computers from America and playing Ultima and Wizardry, and that's quite well documented, fairly well documented. But then also, I also discovered a connection to the British computer industry, as we've just described or discussed, the ZX Spectrum, the ZX81, which was actually sold there. So there has always being a kind of an interplay between all the major regions, and there are stronger connections perhaps than people realize. And so discussing this and getting this information, you know, it was kind of mind-blowing to you know, to see these threads of inspiration, you know, how developers took inspiration from different games and how it influenced them in their own work.
Yes, and I think that also crosses through into music. You interviewed Yuzo Koshiro, and of course he's famous for, you know, Revenge of Shinobi, Streets of Rage series as well. And the Streets of Rage music was kind of influenced by dance music and a lot of like Western music as well. And that kind of crossover of, you know, Japanese culture, Western culture really seemed to work and also help some of those games get massively famous in the West. What was the interview with him like? Because he was an absolute legend. There's so many titles that he's worked on. It was just insane.
Interviewing Yuzo Koshiro was fantastic. Basically, I visited him at his home. His mother made us sandwiches for lunch. It felt very informal, almost like a casual chat with a friend, actually, because, you know, he plays games himself, and so we were discussing various different topics. Now, I actually don't have any formal training in music, so I find interviewing musicians quite challenging because I feel that I don't know the best technical terms. Like with graphics, you know, I can discuss CRT pixel blending or, you know, various, you know, very technical terms, and I can understand it. With music, I know what music I like, and I can say I really enjoyed that sound, but I wouldn't know how to ask octaves or, you know, the technical terms of music. So I find interviewing musicians quite challenging. But he had actually also worked on game creation, not just music creation, but he had developed games as a hobbyist with his friends on the PC-88 computer. So before he became famous as a games musician, he was also creating these hobbyist games, and I was able to ask him about that. And he loaded some of them up on his computer, and we watched and played some of these games, and I filmed him playing one of these hobbyist games where he had taken the graphics from a Falcom game, and he'd made was a sort of a comedy game about cows being abducted by UFOs. And I think he was a little bit embarrassed to be showing, you know, he's
that's earliest. Quite Jeff Minter, that game does.
Yeah, so it it was an amateur work. It wasn't professional work, but I wanted to know this because knowing what, you know, people did before their career, it kind of gives you a better understanding of who they are and what led up to their bigger creations. And, you know, what I discovered is he had really, you know, he grew up playing and working with the PC-88. And famously, you probably know this already, you know, I believe the music for Streets of Rage was actually composed on a PC-88. So It was interesting to see sort of his origin story, as it were. And, you know, he described how he had, when making these games, his sister had done the graphics and he had done the music and some of the level design, and a friend of his did the programming. And so it was great to get these personal stories. And then after that, what I was particularly interested in is his company is basically like a kind of a family-run company. I believe his mother is the CEO, and him and his sister had different roles in it. And his company had created the Master System version of Sonic the Hedgehog under contract to Sega. So, I mean, obviously, Sonic the Hedgehog on the Mega Drive, everybody knows, it's very well documented. And then you'll hear people saying, oh, and, you know, the Master System game is completely different and it's pretty good too. But no one's really described how it came about. So I was quite keen to do that. That it was a great day, basically hanging out with Yuzo Koshiro, especially because so many of the games I'd enjoyed growing up with had his music in it. And we were able to explore topics beyond simply the music he created, but also the games he'd made and the involvement of his family members and, you know, the things he had seen in the industry, kind of growing up first as an enthusiast who played games and then someone who was involved in the creation of them.
Also, like, you know, Streets of Rage as well. There was the cancelled Streets of Rage 4 for the Dreamcast as well.
Yes, yeah, so he described that to me. I believe a video, like a demo video that they had created was leaked onto the internet. And I wanted the inside story from him because his company had pitched Streets of Rage 4 for, you know, the Dreamcast to Sega. His insight, like, so what he said to me was, the reason it didn't get the green light from Sega to be made was because the person they were dealing with at Sega said, Streets of Rage, what's that? Nobody even knows that anymore. And that kind of controversial revelation, you know, that's the kind of thing which a PR person might want to filter out. I mean, nobody would, if I was interviewing someone from Sega or I was going through Sega PR, you know, they wouldn't want anyone to admit that Sega didn't know what Streets of Rage was anymore, because it hints at a company which at that particular moment in time was perhaps slightly out of touch with what players wanted and also slightly out of touch with their own back catalog and portfolio. So it didn't necessarily paint Sega in the best of light, but, you know, it was an honest answer, and he described how they had pitched the idea and what the game was going to involve, and he kind of talked through it. And then it was like, yeah, they, you know, they rejected the idea. And then what I did was I took the interpreted, because the interpreter I hired for that interview was very good. I took her interpreted words and I overlaid them onto the leaked video, basically in order to create a little bit of footage. If you check it out on YouTube, you can probably find a Hardcore Gaming 101 uploaded that segment onto YouTube. But yeah, so unreleased games actually is another topic which I tried to ask as many developers about as possible, either specific ones that I knew they were involved in, or a general blanket question I asked everyone is, did you ever see any game that went unreleased? Because if it was never previewed or it was never documented in a magazine, then it wouldn't be known about at all, even as an unreleased game. And so my fear or my anxiety is there are literally countless and innumerable, unknowable number of unreleased games that were never mentioned or previewed anywhere, reached a certain level of completion and then just disappeared, and nobody knows to ask about them because they don't know they exist, if that makes sense. So something I asked every developer was, can you name or can you think of, or did you even see any unreleased games? And even if they didn't work on any, that doesn't matter. The important thing was, did they perhaps have a colleague who had worked on an unreleased game? Any sort of hint or witnessing of anything? Because if I can get that written down, then that'll be fuel or information for others to go forth and seek more knowledge about that unreleased game.
You know, I'm quite interested as well talking about unreleased things, because there was also, you know, if we're talking about online services as well, like one thing that you mentioned in the books is projects like the online shopping on the Sega Saturn, which I'd never heard of that before. Tell us a bit about that.
So things of that nature where games or, in this case, an online service, which was unique to Japan and never left Japan, there's not going to be a lot of information on it in English because, obviously, if something never left Japan and it never came to America or Europe, you know, nobody's going to talk about it, and you're not going to have first-hand accounts of it. So regarding the online Sega Saturn service, Tominori Sugiyama is the gentleman I spoke to about that, of Vanguard. And this is fascinating because if something has never left Japan, then there's not going to be a lot of documentation, if any, on it in English. So you either need to hope for perhaps a Japanese blog entry where someone describes their experience or use of it, or in this rare and fortuitous case, someone who actually worked on it. And for Tominori Sugiyama, I went on the website, which lists all of their products. And obviously, although it's a discontinued product because it was for the Sega Saturn, his company website was great for listing basically everything the company had ever worked on, sort of like a portfolio that they were quite proud of. And so when I saw this, you know, and it's in Japanese and I'm having to translate it, and, you know, there's not a lot of information to look up either when you Google for it, certainly nothing in English. So that was a great opportunity to document something. Obviously, there's going to be information on it in Japanese, but this was a great opportunity to document it in English. And there's a lot of examples of that. So The Satellaview for the Super Nintendo or Super Famicom, that is a, that's another example. All of this, Japan had a lot of interesting hardware which never left the country. The 64DD, the Satellaview for the Super Famicom, this online shopping system for the Sega Saturn, a myriad of unusual pieces of hardware specific or unique to the way that, you know, the Japanese telecommunications or consumer culture operates. So it's something that really could only function in Japan, or perhaps it had a connection to, you know, those old Japanese smartphones, or before smartphones, you had like special Japanese feature phones, which you didn't really have in the West. And then, of course, once smartphones came out, that line of phone technology sort of died off in Japan, but it was sort of unique to Japan. So that was that all fits in with, you know, what my ultimate goal was, to document with stuff which nobody knew about.
Well, there was a big difference as well, which was the kind of arcade that happened in Japan as well, that development from arcade to gaming hardware as well. And Masamoto Morita was a guy that you interviewed who is very famous for doing Die Hard Arcade. He worked with Sega's arcade division with the AM2 chipset. Can you tell us more about that interview?
That was quite a cool interview as well. I remember when I sat down and I said, we've got to go through all of these, the cool work you did in Sega's arcade division. He didn't actually create Die Hard Arcade. He worked on it alongside Uchida, who was the main guy behind Die Hard Arcade. But he had some cool anecdotes of working alongside the lead director on that. And I remember when we sat down, he was like, I'm not really sure if I can tell you all of these things about Sega. Maybe I should get permission from Sega. And I was like, no, don't worry. It's fine. You don't need permission from Sega. They'll never even find out, because this isn't going to be published in Japan. And that's actually something which a lot of developers were quite keen to know, or they were more relaxed when they knew this wasn't going to be published in Japan. This is only going to be published in Europe, America, outside of Japan, essentially. They had this viewpoint of there is inside Japan where they have to be very careful about what they say, and then there's outside Japan where it kind of doesn't really matter, or they're less concerned about that. So he joined Sega's arcade division, and he went into a lot of detail regarding the Sega Saturn, which was the home system, and then the arcade equivalent of the Sega Saturn. And what was quite interesting, and something he was initially a little bit reluctant to say, was that this hardware within Sega was kind of regarded as not particularly good. That was he said, when we made arcade games, there was hardware which was low cost and not very powerful, but it was okay if you were churning out, let's say, a shooter or something which didn't need a lot of power. And then there was the prestigious, more powerful, expensive hardware, and we would reserve that for fancy racing games and prestigious showcase games where, we wanted everybody to be really wild. And he was basically saying that the Sega Saturn home and arcade hardware was the lower cost, less powerful hardware. So it kind of wasn't as well regarded amongst the arcade division, because everybody wanted to be working on the more powerful stuff. So he was giving personal insights into that, which you wouldn't necessarily get if you went through PR. It was a more honest, basically down to earth, honest kind of answer. And then he discussed.
It's often a wall of silence when we approach Nintendo developers or Sega. So that's always something hard to break through.
Nintendo are their own kind of thing. I mean, something you might notice is I didn't really interview anyone in house from Nintendo. I interviewed people from subsidiaries or third parties. So, for example, Manabu Yamana, he was the programmer on the Dragon Quest series, or various titles in the Dragon Quest series, which is obviously huge on Nintendo hardware, but he worked for Chunsoft, and he described meeting Hiroshi Yamauchi and what a powerful figure he was, and he gave fascinating anecdotes regarding Dragon Quest and Nintendo, but from the perspective of an outside developer that, you know, wasn't actually Nintendo. Because what I found is, occasionally having gotten in contact with people who were actually employed by Nintendo, is they have incredibly strict NDAs, and they like to maintain very tight control over any and all information. So you're never going to get information, or it's very unlikely you're going to get, you know, these kind of stories from anyone working at Nintendo. So just to make my job easier, and knowing what an impossible citadel it is to break into, I didn't pursue any in-house Nintendo leads. I focused only on developers outside of Nintendo, or in the case of the Sega developers, they had left Sega and they were working at their own company, which they owned and controlled, called Arzest. So they were happy to discuss their legacy of work and, you know, kind of promote what they were doing now. You're right, actually. Some companies are incredibly closed off. One good example is I interviewed Professor Kishimoto, who worked on Pac-Land and Baraduke, and he worked alongside other major Namco employees, including the creator of Pac-Land and Masanobu Endo, who made Xevious. So anyway, Professor Kishimoto said to me, Namco does not like any of its employees to discuss Namco games or the history of Namco games. They don't even want the public to know who worked on which games. He gave the example that he created the Family Stadium or Famista baseball games, which are hugely, huge sellers in Japan, incredibly popular and successful. And he was approached for an interview, and basically in Japan by Japanese journalists, and Namco put a stop to it. Namco would not allow him to speak about the games in Japan. And so when I approached him, he said to me, he's agreeing to this interview because he knows Namco won't be able to touch it. If he gives me the information and I take it out of Japan, I can publish it, I can let the world know, and Namco won't be able to stop that, because this also goes into the whole issue of Japanese copyright and the Japanese legal system, which is far more draconian than, you know, in the UK or Europe and America in general. So Japanese companies like to exert, and you can find a lot of examples of this online, like basically exerting control over magazines such as Famitsu. One example is every screenshot of any game in a Japanese magazine has to have approval from the publisher of that game. And if you look at the bottom of the page on, you know, an issue of Famitsu, you will see a copyright declaration citing, you know, who the copyright owner is of the screenshots of whichever game they're covering, which I think is crazy. You know, there's no fair use, or there's no journalistic freedom there. So Professor Kishimoto said to me, I'm giving you all of this good information on what it was like, how Namco worked, how it operated, how he made games, because you have to take this out of Japan and you have to let the world know. And one of the things he gave me was an Excel file listing a whole list of Namco's early arcade games. I want to say like the first 30 up to around the mid-1980s, listing the programmer, the graphics artist, the musician, the hardware creator, because early arcade games, it wasn't just, you know, programming and graphics and music. It was also someone who would design bespoke hardware boards. So he had taken the time to write down every colleague's name, first name and surname, information about them, for example, if they worked under nicknames, etc. And he gave me all of this information, and he was like, you know, take this and let the world know who made these games at Namco, because in Japan, they put a stop to this information getting out. They don't like it. So one of the goals and, you know, a large aspect of these books was kind of breaking through those kinds of barriers and letting these developers' stories be heard, be known, and also, you know, letting their names be known so people can associate a name, they can know who created their favorite games from the last 40 years.
You know, one thing I find interesting as well is when I was a kid, you know, it was often hard to find information about what was happening in, you know, the games industry in Japan, even though a lot of the big systems came from there. I mean, obviously in that kind of pre-internet era, I remember reading, you know, some reports in magazines and TV reports from the Shishinkai Nintendo Space World events and the Tokyo Games Show as well. I mean, have you heard any like kind of stories about like Nintendo Space World that kind of stand out to you and how important those trade shows were?
I got a really, really good anecdote regarding trade shows and Nintendo. So I interviewed the creator of Red Alarm, Mitsuto Nagashima. And if I'm remembering his anecdote to me correctly, he described creating the game, dealing with the Virtual Boy hardware, dealing with Nintendo. And if I remember this correctly, he was asked to create a preview demo, a playable demo of the game for a large trade show for Nintendo, for Nintendo's benefit, to promote the Virtual Boy. And, you know, he worked long hours, you know, like he had like a week to get this done, crunched to get it all done, to get it playable, provided them with a demo. And then at the last minute, Nintendo was like, actually, you know what? We just really want to promote the N64. We're not going to be showing or promoting any of these other games. And he felt kind of disappointed at that, especially, you know, after putting all of that effort into to get that ready for them. But he described the you know, the inner workings of basically some sort of the kind of the background story to what goes into preparing for a trade show such as that. You know, it's quite hectic, a lot of stress, because you basically need to, you know, put your best foot forwards and have essentially this fantastic demo which people can play, and it can capture their attention in a busy environment and also make them excited for the final released game. So, you know, you put all your effort into that, and then in the end, it doesn't actually get showcased, you know, but I mean, that's what happens sometimes. I've got another interesting anecdote regarding Nintendo. If you're curious about it, I was interviewing a developer from Agatsuma, and he actually gave me the business card for Mitsuto Nagashima, because they had been colleagues previously. So he was describing how he had worked on this unreleased real-time strategy game for the PlayStation, PS1. And it was for a company called Marigul, M-A-R-I-G-U-L. And his explanation of it was that Nintendo had co-funded this company. Several large companies had put funding into Marigul. And the point of the company was to come up with creative or interesting or experimental titles. And one of them was this RTS for the PS1, which ended up going unreleased. But I just thought this was fascinating, that essentially Nintendo co-funded the development, perhaps unwittingly, or they certainly put funding into the company, and this company created or worked on a series of titles, including a game for Sony's PlayStation. So, yeah, inadvertently, Nintendo helped co-fund an unreleased RTS for PlayStation, which I thought was interesting. And again, because this was an unreleased game, which had never been documented anywhere or even previewed, you know, you're not going to hear this information anywhere else.
Or if you check your books as well, because I think you have four volumes now, don't you? And where can our listeners get hold of it? And what do you have planned next as well?
So all four volumes can be bought through Amazon, whether it's .com or .co.uk or whichever region you're from, and type in Untold History of Game Developers, and all four volumes, the first three on Japan, and then volume 5, which covers games outside of Japan, it should all be on Amazon.
Fantastic. Well, John, I think it's incredible and really important that you are documenting these stories. And like you said, a lot of this stuff that we haven't heard in the West and isn't available anywhere else. And I think, you know, we've only kind of scratched the surface over the last hour or so with you. Obviously, there's four volumes of your book, so there's a lot out there for people to sink their teeth into.
What I tell everyone is there's over 1 million words of, you know, direct, raw Q&A interviews. There's not a lot of editorial. There's an introduction and there's some box outs and a lot of footnotes. Every page is filled with footnotes. But basically, I love raw Q&A interviews because it gives you the information directly without any sort of padding. And one of my goals with all of the books is you don't have to read it cover. You don't have to start at the beginning and work your way to the end. My hope is you can turn to absolutely any page randomly and find some sort of fascinating, strange anecdote which you had no idea about. I mean, that was my goal, really. Every one of those pages, somewhere there is exciting information which you won't have known about before.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the fact that you've got it over four volumes as well, I think it's, you know, by far the most in-depth view of the Japanese gaming scene ever printed in English. So anyone that's got an interest in kind of, you know, stuff that we may not have heard about before and how the industry worked on the other side of the world and filtered through to the games here in the West as well, I think, you know, fascinating oversight, John. So I'll obviously link that up, the Amazon link in our show notes, so people can click through and hopefully buy some of the books and delve into the information there a bit more. So thank you so much for coming on and sharing some of your stories with us. It's been incredible to get that little insight off you.
No, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to discuss trivia like this. I mean, this is what I love. Fascinating, weird, obscure, unusual stories. It's fun.